The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Good evening, and welcome to The Business of Giving. I'm your host, Denver Frederick, and tonight we'll start with higher education and then move on to online charity auctions. My first guest will be Laura Sparks, the 13th president of the Cooper Union. It's a remarkable institution started by Peter Cooper back in 1859.
There's a wonderful story that we tell about the school and how Peter Cooper set it up, which is that as students entered, they would enter from the south side of the building. That's the working class of Manhattan lived on the south side of the island. And as students graduated, they would exit through the north side of the building, really symbolizing what opportunity they had created for themselves from coming to the Cooper Union.
And then you'll hear from Ben Irwin, the president of Charity Buzz. They are part of the Charity Network, and Ben will tell us exactly what they do.
First is Charity Buzz, full-service auction company, really focus on high-net-worth individuals. Think about it as the digital version of the gala. Instead of running your live auction for 300-400 people in a hotel ballroom, put it in front of our virtual stadium, 200,000-plus high-net-worth individuals who are socially conscious, engaged, and want access to the types of things we put on the site.
But first, the Business of Giving News Digest for Sunday, March 3rd. Overall giving flatlined in 2018, increasing just 1.5%, according to a new report from the Black Bought Institute. 48% of female undergrads at Duke say they were sexually assaulted while enrolled. In the forests of Central Africa, the population of mountain gorillas, one of the world's most endangered species, was reported to have increased by 25% since 2010. Germany released new figures showing that more than 300,000 refugees have now found jobs, and the share of MPs with migrant backgrounds has risen from 3% to 9% in the last two elections. And finally, the share of black men in poverty in the United States fell from 41% in 1960 to 18% today. And their share in the middle class rose from 38% to 57% over the same time. And that is a Business of Giving News Digest for this Sunday evening. I'll be back to speak with Laura Sparks of the Cooper Union right after this.
Before you give to charity, go to charitynavigator.org. Charity Navigator provides free ratings of thousands of America's largest charities, helping you get the most out of your charitable dollar. charitynavigator.org, your guide to intelligent giving. Follow the Business of Giving on Twitter at BizOfGive and at Facebook.com/BusinessOfGiving. And now, back to the Business of Giving with your host, Denver Frederick, on AM 970, The Answer.
It was 160 years ago, 1859, that the Cooper Union for the Advancement of Science and Art was established. It is one of the most distinguished, interesting, and historic institutions of higher education in the country, and one that has faced some significant financial challenges in recent years. Here with us tonight to talk about all of that and much more is Laura Sparks, the 13th president of the Cooper Union. Good evening, Laura, and welcome to the Business of Giving.
Thank you. Thanks so much for having me.
You know, it's often said that an organization is ahead of its time, but I don't know too many organizations that could lay a more convincing claim to that than the Cooper Union and its founder, Peter Cooper. Tell us a little bit about the founding and some of the history of the institution.
Yeah, so, you know, to talk about the institution really requires talking about its founder. Peter Cooper had a vision for this institution that was very much ahead of its time and in many ways still is. He was an extraordinary man. He was an industrialist. He had less than a year of formal education himself, and he became a very wealthy man. And he decided that what he wanted to do with that wealth was to create opportunities for people that he didn't have himself. So he didn't have a formal education, and he decided that he wanted other working class people to have that. And so he established the Cooper Union. He did many other things as well. He helped establish the public school system in New York City. He was incredibly well connected within government circles, and that became really important to what Cooper Union ended up becoming. But the what he tried to do was to live, in some ways, a very simple life, but to really advance democracy as we have come to know it, and as I hope we know it in the future. He decided that he wanted to establish a school. But before that, he just wanted people to have access to books and to knowledge. His efforts predated free libraries. He wanted people to have access to information, and he wanted them to have access to it on their own time. So he opened a free public reading room that was open after people finished work, where people could go and read books and absorb knowledge and improve their own prospects in life. Eventually, he decided that he wanted to create a school, and he spent many years planning it, amassing the land for it, and conceiving of a building that would house the school. There's a wonderful story that we tell about the school and how Peter Cooper set it up, which is that as students entered, they would enter from the south side of the building. That's the working class of Manhattan lived on the south side of the island. And as students graduated, they would exit through the north side of the building, really symbolizing what opportunity they had created for themselves from coming to the Cooper Union.
What a lovely rite of passage that is.
Absolutely. For him, education was about two things. It was about building somebody's skill and the tools that they would need to increase their own economic livelihood, improve their own life for themselves and their families. And it was about educating people who could become public citizens, again, in service of advancing a healthy democracy. And that's still very much how we think about education at the Cooper Union.
Yeah, and at a very exclusionary time, even more so than today, this was open to just about everybody, correct?
That's right. Peter Cooper wanted to create an institution that provided the best education to everyday people. Working class people at the time didn't have access to the elite institutions of the day. He wanted people to have access to that same kind of education. He believed that education of the highest quality should be open to people regardless of race, regardless of gender, regardless of religion, regardless of socioeconomic status. And you have to remember that was happening pre-Civil War. So again, a man before his time, and a man who I think set the tone for an institution that endures through today and whose guiding principles I think are still critical to our institution and to society at large.
And I think if we look at the concept of continuing education, it really had its birth there as well, right?
It did. So one of the things we talk a lot about is the fact that, you know, in many ways, Cooper Union is known as an undergraduate institution, and that is the core of what we do. We bring to Cooper Union extraordinary human beings, and they go out into the world and they do extraordinary things. They do that having spent their time as undergraduates here. But we also have programs that outreach to students that are much younger and much older. So we have art outreach programs, STEM outreach programs that are really trying to create opportunities for students who may not have art programs in their public schools or who may be immigrants who were engineers in their home countries and have the capacity to be contributing and earning at much higher levels in this country, but for necessary certifications and licensure programs. So we have an immigrant training program for engineers who often come into the program and triple their wages once they leave. So for us, education spans someone's entire life, and we want to play a role in all of that.
And for people who may not be that familiar with the Cooper Union, you are divided into three schools. What would those schools be?
Our schools are art, architecture, and engineering, three core disciplines that we think are incredibly important in the shaping of a modern society.
Mm-hmm. Another part of the school that has been very important in shaping a modern society has been the Great Hall, which is located in the basement level of the Foundation Building, and that has been the site of some of the most notable and memorable addresses and other activities in the history of this country. Share a few of those with us.
I will. So to understand kind of the Great Hall and its connection to our academic program, you also have to understand that in addition to our three schools of art, architecture, and engineering, we also have a humanities program. The one thing that Peter Cooper required that the school teach was political science.
Mm-hmm.
And that continues to be a guiding principle for us. the school is celebrating our 160th anniversary this year. But the Great Hall actually opened a year before the school in 1858. Mm-hmm. So the Great Hall opened in 1858, and it was really designed from the beginning by Peter Cooper to be a platform for public discourse, a place of civic organizing, a place of activism. Again, part of this effort to really encourage a robust and healthy democracy. So the Great Hall is where Abraham Lincoln made his famous Right Makes Might speech, where mm-hmm. he argued against the expansion of slavery. And Lincoln credits that speech to launching his bid to the presidency. We've had 10 U.S. presidents speak in the Great Hall, and movements have been born there. One of Peter Cooper's innovations at the time was to use the building to generate revenue. So he would lease out the first floor of the foundation building to generate rents that could then pay for the school. He rented an office on the second floor to Susan B. Anthony. And she and Elizabeth Cady Stanton would go downstairs and organize and advocate for a woman's right to vote in the Great Hall. Early meetings to form the NAACP took place in the Great Hall. We've had extraordinary moments that have really shaped in many ways the history of this country. It's where some of the first workers' rights campaigns took place. It's where some of the first mass feminist meetings took place. This has been a place where people have been willing to take a risk and use their voice to put ideas forward that could shape the future of this country.
What a rich history. You know, another part of that history has been free tuition, but in 2014, for the first time in your history, the Cooper Union was forced to charge tuition to some of the students attending the school. What were the events, the missteps, the financial hardships that occurred that made you have to take this difficult decision?
Yeah, you know, Cooper Union in many ways experienced something that felt deeply personal to the institution. Free tuition for Cooper Union, yes, was about full tuition scholarships for our students, but it was also about so much more than money. It's really about our culture, our identity, mm-hmm. the ability to take risks. And so the decision and the things that led to it felt deeply personal. At the same time, as I've worked to kind of deconstruct what happened prior to my arrival, what I've come to understand is that so many of the things that Cooper Union was facing were really typical of what other colleges and universities are facing. Most colleges and universities have experienced a situation where the expense base has outstripped revenues over time. Things have become more expensive. Healthcare has become more mm-hmm. expensive. Operating buildings has become more expensive. And over time, for the Cooper Union and for many other colleges and universities, revenues have not kept pace. And that's what happened with the Cooper Union.
Well, certainly New York City's become more expensive. It's a tough place to do business.
It is.
No matter what you're doing.
It's a tough place to do business. It's a tough place for students to live. It's extraordinarily expensive, which is why we feel so passionate in part about full tuition scholarships for all students. And yet New York City is, as you know, an amazing place. You know, Cooper Union is sort of this small but mighty institution that's nestled in the East Village and yet in the midst of a global city. And that combination, our size, the intimacy of it, and the ability to be in the midst of such extraordinary things happening is really special and really creates a learning environment that I think is deeply rich for our students.
And I know you have a plan to return to free, which we'll get to in a minute, but I think a lot of listeners might not realize that one of your most significant assets and a source of revenue is the land under the Chrysler Building. Tell us a little bit about that and how significant it is to the well-being of the school and its operations.
Yeah, so in the early 1900s, Andrew Carnegie gave a gift to the Cooper Union that helped create the endowment that would ultimately fund what was called the Polytechnic Institute, which became the engineering school. As a match to that gift, Peter Cooper's family gifted us the land where the Chrysler Building now sits. And so that land has been part of our history for a very long time. The Chrysler Building was built on it, and we benefit from that through ground lease revenue. So we collect ground lease revenue. It's a significant part of our capital structure and our revenue sources. And we use that money to fund full tuition scholarships for our students.
You know, you're a very interesting organization. So many different facets. Well, you arrived in 2017, and I know part of what you're doing right now is this effort to return to free by 2029. And among other things, that's going to take a significant fundraising campaign. What are your plans for that? And what provides you the hope and confidence that you're going to be able to reach that target and that goal in order to be able to return to free in the next decade?
Yeah, so the plan is an ambitious one, and it requires several things, including fundraising. It includes also expense management, mm-hmm. And so we've put ourselves on a rigorous expense management plan, which we're ahead of schedule on. It requires amassing additional resources for scholarships, and it requires investing in our academic program, because we've always said that the beauty of Cooper Union was not only that it offered full tuition scholarships for its students, but that it was an extraordinary academic institution. Fundraising is a big part of it, and part of what gives me confidence is that we've had some really good success early on in the plan. We exceeded our financial goals by all measures in the first year of the plan, and we are well on our way in the second year of the plan. That gives me confidence that we have the momentum that we'll need to achieve the plan. Overall, we need to amass $250 million over the course of this next 10 years, and that will come from a combination of fundraising and operating surpluses that we will generate through more efficient management of the school.
Do you like fundraising?
I do.
You
know? I like fundraising when I really care about what I'm raising money for.
Deeply believe in it. Yeah.
It doesn't feel like fundraising when you're passionate about what you're raising money for. It feels like you're sharing an extraordinary opportunity for people to be part of something that will really change the world.
Is there a danger, Laura, maybe not with you, but others around you, that getting back to free will so dominate the conversation, the focus, the energy of the institution that other things are in danger of falling by the wayside?
I do think that's a risk, and it's a risk that we've tried to be very mindful of. We care deeply about the return to full tuition scholarships for all students. We also, as I said, care deeply about the educational experience of our students. Offering an education free of financial burden allows people to take risks, to explore, to make the kinds of discoveries that we hope will influence society for the better for generations to come. And that's why full tuition scholarships is so important to us. In order for all of those benefits to manifest, we also need to make sure that we're creating a learning environment that is rich with experiences for our students. And so our 10-year plan to return to full tuition scholarships is also a plan about investing in the academic program. It's also a plan about investing in the long-term health and sustainability for the institution. One of the things that we're very clear about is that when we return to full tuition scholarships for all students, we want to be able to sustain that in perpetuity. And to do that, we need to make sure that we shore up the long-term financial health of the school. One of the things that we also often talk about is the fact that although we're not currently offering full tuition scholarships to all students, many of our students still are on full tuition scholarships. Over a third of our students still receive full tuition scholarships. Everybody receives at least a 50% scholarship and upwards from there. On average, we're covering 76% of tuition costs for our students. So our work right now is to really close that critical gap between 76% and 100% because we feel it is so important to send people off into the world without that financial
burden. Well, I'm glad you included that, because sometimes that gets lost in the headlines when you have something like this is going on.
Yes.
You know, with all that's going on, I mean, raising the money and cutting the expenses that you mentioned and just a lot of other change within the institution, I know how difficult that can be. How do you think about change management to make it productive, successful, keep people on board and optimistic about the future?
Yeah, I'm glad you asked that question, because people think about change management in very different ways. There are some people who believe that the way to make fundamental change, long-term change, massive change, is to tear everything down and start all over again. I don't believe in that. I think often we burn too many bridges when we do that. I believe that to have long-term sustained change that outlives any one person, it's really critical to bring many people on board for that change and to collaborate and partner with people who have been part of an institution for a very long time. We have people at the Cooper Union who have spent their entire careers there. They've done that because they are deeply passionate about the mission of the school, and they have a depth of knowledge about the institution that I couldn't even begin to have as somebody who's been there for just 2 years.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's really important to work in partnership with those people who have that depth of passion and longevity with the institution to make sure that they're part of the change, to make sure that they inform the change, and also to bring new people to the institution who bring another kind of perspective. And I think the strongest outcome comes when you marry those two things.
I think you're right. And it's interesting, from the changes that I've seen in institutions, even dramatic changes, most everything stays the same. You know, more than half of it is going to remain the same, and we don't ever think about that. We think about all the things that are going to change. Let me ask you a few questions as a college president. And I think one thing that you and many of your compatriots are always wrestling with is how to maintain the right balance between freedom of speech on one hand and an environment where people feel safe and not needlessly offended on the other. How do you navigate those waters?
Yeah, so, you know, a lot of people talk about those things as though they're mutually exclusive, when in fact I think that they're mutually reinforcing. I think that in order to have free speech and productive free speech and speech where people can really engage in dialogue and healthy debate, it's important to create spaces where people feel comfortable doing that. And I think we do that in many different ways. I think that's about creating relationships. It's about creating spaces for people to come together. Last night, I sat with students at a community dinner. We've started instituting community dinners.
Nice.
We've got a for those who know the building, you know that we have a bank of windows along the west side of the building that creates what we call a colonnade. And we put a very long dining table there. And the dinners are open to anyone, faculty, students, staff. And it's just a time to pause, to take stock, and to be with one another. It seems like a small, informal thing, and yet those are the kinds of things that I think create the space and the safety for people to engage in dialogue and debate that is rich, that's healthy, that's productive, and where we can learn from one another. Issues around free speech are in the news a lot, and they're loud, and they're visible, and they're sometimes bombastic, and I think that if we are truly to learn from one another, we have to create an environment where people can have intimate conversations about differences of opinion. I also think that as educators, it's really incumbent upon us to make sure that we are developing skills in ourselves and in the students who come through our doors to be able to do that. So I think back to my own college experience and a professor who influenced me in really significant ways. And I remember a talk that he gave outside of the classroom where he said very clearly, if somebody were to ask me where I stand on the political spectrum, I would say that if you stood all the way to the left and squinted through a pair of binoculars, you still would not be able to see me. And yet in the classroom, he was an economics professor. He was the best teacher of Milton Friedman. And why? Why was he the best teacher of Milton Friedman? Because he believed in the importance of showing his students a range of perspectives on the economy, a range of perspectives that then inform policy decision, so that we could be empowered to make our own choices, our own decisions, develop our own perspectives in ways that were independent from his. That, to me, was one of the greatest gifts that a faculty member could have given me, and I'm excited for us to creating spaces at Cooper Union where we can offer that to our students as well.
Yeah, and he was also pretty influential in getting you off of pre-med.
He was.
And moving in this direction.
Yeah, so I grew up in a medical family.
I know.
My father
doctor
was
and a nurse.
That's right. And so I always assumed that I was going to be a doctor. I knew exactly what kind. I was going to be a neonatologist. I wrote all my college essays about it, with the exception of one. One of my college essays was a poem. And I went to Wellesley College to become a doctor.
Yeah.
But I was in a liberal arts institution, and the school did a wonderful job of encouraging students to try new things. And I got to the second semester of my first year, and I thought to myself, I'm at a liberal arts school. I don't really understand what philosophy is, but it seems like I should take a philosophy course. And I don't really understand what economics is, but I had heard that Wellesley had a wonderful economics department. And so I happened to take Introduction to Macroeconomics and Introduction to Moral Philosophy at the same time. And the combination of those two courses opened my eyes to the world in a way that I hadn't experienced before. I knew I wanted to be a doctor because I was interested in helping people, mm-hmm. and I thought that medicine was one way to do that. Philosophy and economics gave me a way of looking at the complexities and the challenges of the world in an entirely new way and opened my eyes to the myriad ways that one can have a positive outcome in the world.
You know, I look at so many of these successful entrepreneurs, at least the ones who went to college, and invariably one out of every two was a philosophy major. And it's just so interesting. You know, another thing that's in the news a lot is diversity. Mm-hmm. And I know that your campus and others across the country, students are calling for greater diversity among faculty and administration. How have you addressed those concerns at the Cooper Union?
So we've tried to tackle those issues head on. To me, having a diversity of people at the school is critical to offering an education that is what we want it to be. And I think of diversity in many ways. I think of it with respect to gender, with respect to race, mm-hmm. with respect to experience, and with respect to beliefs. And so we try to think about diversity in many ways. Our Faculty Student Senate raised this issue actually prior to my arrival and issued a report in my early days there on what they saw as opportunities for improvement with respect to diversity at the Cooper Union. That work was, I thought, critical, and it informed a task force that I launched at the school focused on diversity and inclusion. That task force was open to all to participate. So we had faculty, staff, and students on it, and they issued a report at the end of last semester, which we're now in the process of implementing recommendations mm-hmm. from. So we've tried to make sure that even the process of exploring these issues takes into account diverse viewpoints, diverse people, people who come from lots of different backgrounds, and we've tried to make sure that it's an inclusive process.
Great. You know, I've heard people say, Laura, that being the president of a college is like running a small nation state. And given that no 2 days of yours are ever the same, how do you spend your time and how do you prioritize with all the competing claims on that time and for your attention?
That's a great question because the role is a complex one. There's been much that's been written about that. And I try to prioritize my time by grounding myself in the core reasons why I'm there in the first place. First and foremost, for me, it's about the students and the faculty. They are the heart and soul of our institution. They are what makes it what it is. Everything else is designed to support their work, to advance their work. So I start first and foremost with students and faculty. And as I said, I spent yesterday evening with them in community, having dinner and in conversation.
Which is great for them because it's not online. You know? Yeah. I mean, it really, and that's where you really get the great
that's
discussions.
Right. It yeah. gives us a place to physically come together yeah. and to share conversation and ideas. So that grounds what I do, and it helps me set my priorities throughout the day. Of course, I can't spend all my time at dinners. There's core work to be done. One of our core priorities is to shore up the long-term financial health of the institution so that we can offer full tuition scholarships for our students. So I try to make sure that I'm spending actually a lot of time with our head of finance and administration, making sure that our plan is on track. Mm-hmm. I spend a lot of time with our development team and with donors who are excited about contributing to Cooper Union's mission. I try to spend my time making sure that we are aggregating the resources that we need to deliver on a mission that is about educating students to go off into the world and to make a difference.
Describe what it's like to work at the Cooper Union, the corporate culture. I mean, what do you do to help shape it and influence? And what do you believe makes it such a special place for employees to come to every morning?
Well, you know, as I said earlier, the Cooper Union is a place where people have both joined recently and have spent many years all for the same reason, which is to advance the mission of our school. And people don't come to the Cooper Union just to work in a college. They come to the Cooper Union because it's the Cooper Union. They've come because they want to be part of a place that is working to restore full tuition scholarships for all students and all that that represents, the notions of equality, of equity, of diversity. And I see that passion on a daily basis. It permeates throughout our buildings, and I think that's what defines our culture. As somebody who has come from corporate environments, I try very much to stay away from the notion that our culture is a corporate one.
Mm-hmm.
It is a culture with heart and with soul, and with a commitment to improving the lives of people on a daily basis.
Yeah, I think sometimes we're lucky to get the best of both worlds in this sector. If you can really meld them together, it's somewhere in the middle.
That's right.
That produces just a great organization.
Right.
Yeah, talk a little bit about that journey. I know you came from, you started at Goldman Sachs, for goodness sake, and now you're at the Cooper Union. Tell us a little bit about that. And were there any mentors, Laura, along the way, or people who really inspired you?
So I have been so fortunate to have such a varied career, and I think that that variation has really served me well at the Cooper Union. As you've noted, these are complex roles, and they require skills in finance, in the law, in education,
plumbing
in
almost,
culture,
everything.
Everything. And so I've been really fortunate to have had so many different kinds of experiences in the business world, in the nonprofit world, in the education world, in the philanthropic world. And I have had mentors at every stop along the way. I think I'm someone who tends to see opportunity in just about everything that I do. And I've been really fortunate to have had people who have guided me and who have created opportunity for me all along the way. So, I had someone at Goldman Sachs who believed that I didn't need three other people between me and the partner on a deal. That gave me tremendous both confidence and opportunity to pursue things that were probably far beyond my years from any typical measure. That happened, one, because I proved myself, but two, because he was willing to take that leap with me, and I'm still in touch with him. I just exchanged emails with him the other day. When I was at Wellesley College, I mentioned I had a faculty member, many faculty members who were hugely influential in my life.
Which I guess is one of the reasons you love so much being in education, because what education did for you to change your trajectory is sort of a pay it forward.
That's right. So for me, this is an extraordinary time in somebody's life, right? Typically between the ages of 18 and 22, although sometimes younger, sometimes older. This is a moment in one's life where you have the opportunity and you're at a stage in life where you're really thinking about who you are as a person, who you've been, who you want to become. Hopefully we're always doing that in life, but this is a particularly important time
you're
in
right.
the development of someone's life. And it's one of the things that excites me so much about the students at Cooper. I've been really fortunate to go to some pretty amazing institutions of higher education. And yet I have never seen students like the ones I see at Cooper. They are simultaneously focused, passionate, active, engaged, and have such a strong desire to influence the place where they are and have so many ideas to advance those desires. So just in the last few days, I've had conversations with students who have really important ideas about our physical space, the way it looks, the way it makes people feel, and they have ideas that they're putting forward about that. I've talked with students just yesterday, had a conversation with a student who's talking about the work that our students are doing to mobilize around issues of climate change and how to integrate issues of climate change more directly into our curriculum and into the pedagogical approaches at the school. We have students who have actively participated in the issues around diversity and inclusion and in the task force. They are at Cooper Union because they're focused on their practice, their art practice, their architecture practice, their engineering practice, their work in the humanities to deepen and expand the way they think. And they amplify that with the work that they're doing to make our community stronger in very deliberate and active ways.
Yeah, that's wonderful, because I think when you get students involved in that fashion, they're no longer students, but they rather become owners of the school. This is their place now. They're decorating it. They're creating things. And when you get an owner mindset among students, you really have arrived, I think.
That's right. And I learn things from our students every single day. One of the things that I instituted when I came to the Cooper Union was to have office hours. You can sign up online. You don't have to go through any gatekeeper. Mm-hmm. You don't have to tell me even what you want to talk about before you get there. And part of why I did that was because I wanted people to know that, you know, the office of the president is an accessible place. The other reason why I did that, even more importantly, was because I knew that I would learn a lot from the people who would come to those meetings. And I do. I've continued to have those office hours because every single day I'm learning from our students, our faculty, our staff who take me up on the offer to talk.
Yeah, no, it's very smart. As I said, it's very easy to lose touch as a president of a university or a college unless you maintain that touch. Let me close with this, Laura. The DNA of Cooper Union is progressive roots. Boy, that's an extraordinary legacy that you now help to carry. What is your vision for the institution over the course of the next several years?
So my vision is multi-pronged, right? Of course, I want to restore the school to full tuition scholarships, and we're working very hard to do that. I want the school to be, as we say in our mission statement, to be a center, a free center of learning and civic discourse that inspires inventive, creative, and influential voices in architecture, art, and engineering to address the critical challenges and opportunities of our time. The world is changing rapidly. And the core disciplines of art, architecture, and engineering, when we consider them in humanist ways, when we consider them in ways that take into account the ethical, the environmental consequences of what we're doing, have the power, I think, to really shape modern society in very fundamental and important ways. So I'm excited about being part of an institution that is working every single day to do that in a way that is vibrant and dynamic, to do that in a way that considers our students, our faculty, our staff as partners, and as collaborators to do this work every single day.
Well, Laura Sparks, the president of the Cooper Union, I want to thank you so much for being here this evening. For people who want to learn more about the school, maybe some of the events and activities occurring in the Great Hall and other things that are happening around campus, what is your website and what will they find on it?
Our website is www.cooper.edu. You'll find loads of information about our history, about the future that we're trying to create, and about our alumni. I would really encourage people to look at the stories of our alumni. You know, as I said before, we are a small but mighty place. You know, people like to say we punch above our weight. And you don't have to take my word for it. You can simply look at what the extraordinary people who come through our doors have done. I look at people like Dick Schwartz, who is an engineering grad who helped create GPS and recently received the Queen Elizabeth Prize for Engineering, one of the most prestigious mm-hmm. prizes that you can receive in the world. Stan Lapidus, who revolutionized the pap smear for women. Nina Tandon, another engineer who started a company called EpiBone, which is developing synthetic bone and will change the course of how we deal with people's medical challenges over time. Liz Diller and Rick Scafidio, people who are well known in New York but also the world over, who just were awarded the Royal Academy Prize of Architecture. Eric Mack, a young art grad who has a solo show at the Brooklyn Museum. These are extraordinary people doing extraordinary things. And what we often overlook is that in addition to all of these big names and all of these prestigious prizes that Cooper Union grads have amassed, we also have people who are making change in less visible ways, but equally important ways in their communities. People who are sitting on their local planning boards, artists who are working with their neighbors to create a more vibrant community for themselves. The vision for Cooper Union is to be a place that embraces all of those kinds of change. People can have impact in their communities and in the world in so many different ways. And I'm excited about the fact that Cooper Union creates space for people to do that.
A wonderful note to end on. Thanks so much, Laura. It was a real pleasure to have you on the show.
Great. Thanks so much for having me. You're doing incredible work.
Thank you. I'll be back with more of The Business of Giving right after this.
The Nature Conservancy believes in a world where nature and people can thrive together. Visit nature.org now to learn more about how you can be our partner.
Welcome back to the Business of Giving with Denver Frederick.
Many listeners who have attended charity galas are familiar with the auction part of the evening, as a nonprofit strives to raise additional revenue from those in attendance. And in recent years, many of these auctions have been conducted online to reach an even bigger audience. The world's premier full-service charity auction site is CharityBuzz, which offers once-in-a-lifetime experiences to a community of hundreds of thousands of bidders. And it's a pleasure to have with us tonight Ben Irwin, the president of CharityBuzz. Good evening, Ben, and welcome to the Business of Giving.
Good evening, and thank you so much for having me. Excited to be here.
CharityBuzz is part of the Charity Network. Tell us about the parent company and the other components in addition to yourself.
Sure. So Charity Network is a relatively new entity, been around for a little over 3 years, founded by Todd Wagner, the owner and CEO. And it comprises three separate businesses that each tackle a very specific problem all charitable organizations need. First is CharityBuzz, full-service auction company, really focus on high-net-worth individuals. Think about it as the digital version of the gala. Instead of running your live auction for 300-400 people in a hotel ballroom, put it in front of our virtual stadium, 200,000-plus high-net-worth individuals who are socially conscious, engaged, and want access to the types of things we put on the site. Second platform is Prizeo.com. Still focusing on the experience, the access, but we're democratizing the method of entry, a true sweepstakes model, which allows organizations to receive smaller donations for thousands, tens of thousands, in some cases even hundreds of thousands of new donors, which could result in millions and millions of new unrestricted dollars for the benefiting organization. And the third business is Global Philanthropy Group, the newest of the three to enter into the charity network. Traditional consulting firm, but focused on impact, strategic philanthropy, an incredible team of experts in the space who not only do the research, the recommendations, but they do the implementation and the execution, which really differentiates themselves from the rest of the consulting world.
How many nonprofit organizations, Ben, has CharityBuzz work with, and how much money have you been able to help them raise?
Glad you asked. I am most proud of these two statistics. We've been in business for a little over 10 years. Mm-hmm. We've raised over $300 million for 4,000-plus charitable organizations. That number continues to grow significantly. Last year was our best year ever. This year we're projecting growth. So we're really eager to cross that half a billion and hopefully that billion-dollar number a lot faster than it took us to get to $300 million.
Very exciting. What do you do for a nonprofit client? For instance, do you help them secure a celebrity or an experience, or is it more focused on the marketing and the back-end operations?
So the latter, for sure. You know, we fancy ourselves as a technology platform.
Mm-hmm.
We do not solicit donations for any of our partners. But what we've built is this really unique marketplace. CharityBuzz is a destination to live out your wildest dreams and support a great cause. It's unlike a ballroom or an auction that an organization has ever been a part of. So we like to leverage all of the best practices and insights of what our users want, what our marketplace supports, and empower our partners to go out to their network of supporters and engage them in new and exciting ways. From there, as I mentioned, we have about 200,000 high net worth individuals. So we are always thinking about new ways to target them, get the right information in front of the right person so that we can increase dollars raised and help organizations reach a brand new audience of donors.
Well, Ben, take our listeners through the process of, let's say, a typical auction for the charity, for the celebrity, for the bidder. How long do these things go on and things of that nature?
So when CharityBuzz first started, we were mimicking probably the auction season of most charitable organizations. We would do an auction around the spring gala or the fall gala. But as we really started morphing into a platform, we're now hosting auctions 365 days a year, which gives our partners more flexibility, more freedom to take advantage of time-sensitive opportunities, match their listings with peaks in the market. I always use sports as my reference because I'm kind of a sports nut. But if you had tickets to the Super Bowl, it would be a lot more beneficial to post them in December or January than right now, because we know the market will be 5-10x at that point.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, we engage with charitable organizations at many different phases throughout their auction process. In some cases, they'll come to us with a fully baked idea, and it's a matter of us optimizing it, putting together a launch plan, and getting it on the website. And in some cases, they'll say, we know we want to work with you. How do we get the process started? And that becomes a little more consultative. We sit down with them. We understand their entire web of sponsors, board members, supporters, committee members. And then we show them all the different ways they could be engaging these people to support them in a completely different way. In a lot of cases, it's transitioning the check writer to also be offering up a lunch, a round of golf at their private club. You know, the possibilities are endless, which is the most exciting part of our business.
Being the experts on charity auctions, aside from maybe not working with Charity Buzz, what are some of the most common mistakes a nonprofit will make with their own charity auction?
I think a lot of it starts with this notion that auctions have to be at the gala and only available to the 300-400 people in attendance. You know, over the years, this has definitely shifted, but the notion has been that our guests need this auction. They come to our event to bid on this auction. I've even heard organizations say, we know that we could raise more money with you, but we don't want to upset a couple of our key supporters who like coming to our event and get a bargain.
Mm-hmm.
These are fundraisers, and our mission is to maximize the amount of dollars raised. So really just keeping that central concept in mind, that if you have access to great opportunities or experiences, auctions are a numbers game. If you get that in front of a larger group of people who are engaged, the only people that come to Charity Buzz are individuals who are looking to bid. There's no content. There's nothing else. It is a shopping experience, for lack of a better term. So some of these old school ideas about the auction, about what guests want, I'd say is the biggest mistake, because they're starting off at a point that isn't necessarily informed by reality.
Yeah, yeah. Give us a few examples of some of your more successful auctions and how much money they were able to raise.
Yeah, so, you know, the most exciting part about Charity Buzz to me, as someone who's been there almost since the beginning, is the evolution of the marketplace.
Mm-hmm.
It started off as primarily offering up celebrity experiences. And while that remains a very popular category, in order for this business to grow, we had to widen the parameters and figure out how else could we engage a larger number of charitable organizations. A great example of that is back in 2013, we were fortunate enough to auction off a cup of coffee, 30 minutes, at Apple headquarters with Tim Cook.
Mm-hmm.
Everyone in the office was excited. This was cool. Was it going to raise $25, $50, $100,000? We didn't really have any comps to reference. 3 weeks later, the auction raises $610,000.
Oh, my.
Generates over 1 billion media impressions, mm-hmm. all referencing the benefiting organization, Robert F. Kennedy mm-hmm. Human Rights. So incredible awareness. And then if we want to just stay on the Apple bandwagon, about 3 years ago, we auctioned off one of the first Apple One motherboards
yeah.
that Jobs and Woz created in a garage outside Cupertino. Probably the farthest thing from the celebrity experience the business started, but we kind of took a page out of a traditional auction house, did a lot of pre-auction prospecting, marketing, and we ended up selling it for over $800,000, oh. which today remains the single highest hammer price we've ever achieved on Charity Buzz. So, you know, we've really made this entire spectrum as wide as can be and are always thinking about new ways to leverage what we've built to help more organizations succeed.
Well, picking up on Tim Cook, have celebrity entrepreneurs and iconic business leaders become a really sought-after market for these bidders?
Today, business experiences are our most successful and popular
really?
Category. Mm. So we like to say that when the Tim Cook auction happened in 2013, it was a watershed moment for Charity Buzz. Everyone's scratching their heads. Okay, business experiences are appealing to our base. many more charities have access to business leaders through their board of directors than A-list celebrities. Let's really start pushing this out, suggesting this as an avenue for our organizations and new organizations. And that was probably best memorialized in our first ever entrepreneur auction, which happened back in 2015, which was the first time that Charity Buzz created our own auction. So instead of it being the Ben Irwin Foundation auction, where the only thing that was connecting all the different auction items was the cause, we started looking at categories. So let's get 100 different organizations to each donate one or two experiences with business leaders. But let's put it all under this big umbrella and then use all of our marketing channels, all of the targeting that's available, and create an online event that kind of helps move all of these organizations up in terms of dollars raised. And it remains one of our most successful campaigns. We just finished the 2018 one up in December, and it raised nearly $1.5 million.
Mm-hmm. And some of these business experiences with these leaders are just not to get to know them. People sometimes come in with a mission and a plan, correct?
Absolutely. You know, we like to kind of market them or position them as a foot in the door.
Yeah.
And this is
interesting.
In a lot of cases, the only way you could get in with head of a big hedge fund, CEO of a Fortune 500 company. And what's really cool is you're walking into this meeting with a shared connection that you just supported an organization that business leader is passionate about. So a lot of these experiences begin with the business leader thanking the winning bidder for supporting their organization. So the icebreaker's a little out of the way, and you can kind of make the most of these 30 minutes to an hour. And there's been examples where that relationship has existed beyond that initial meeting, and there's been deals made, there's been relationships forged. And so it's a really cool and unique aspect of our business. We are continuously strengthening and putting muscle behind.
Another piece of your business is Charity Buzz Curates. What's that about?
So the entrepreneur auction was the beginning, the foundation of Curates. So after that succeeded for the first 2 years, again, another head scratcher. How can we make this bigger and better and use it to help more organizations take advantage of what we've built? So we looked through, we did a huge analysis of the data. What are the areas where we have a unique strength in, meaning they succeed above average on the site, that we also believe a large percentage or high number of our partners have access to these types of things? So it's become golf, it's become Broadway, it's become fashion, and it's become music, which based on just the types of organizations we work with, we have an incredible variety of music connections and experiences, which will be on display in Charity Buzz Curates Music, which will be happening later this spring, which will have everything from signed guitars, meet and greets with Billboard's top artists, to the chance to have your demo listened to by an A&R executive at a top record label. Again, this notion of foot in the door. This is how maybe you get your big break.
You mentioned a moment ago that you're a sports guy. So let me ask you this about that industry. How can teams, players, and experiences be better leveraged and utilized to raise more money for the participating charity?
So in reality, the world of sports is very philanthropic. You've got professional athletes who do an incredible amount of work in their communities, in the schools, around junior sports leagues.
Yeah.
I don't think they get enough credit.
Mm-hmm.
You only hear the bad news about athletes, the few bad apples, so to speak, who are breaking the law or getting in trouble. But you very rarely hear about the football player who has single-handedly funded and revamped the junior football program in his hometown that's been in a great after-school program. So I think, for one, the teams, the leagues, the agencies need to do a better job of celebrating what these guys are already doing, because that would then encourage the newer generation, the newer players, to be following in the footsteps of them, because it's good for business. You know, I think sponsorships, the limelight would only increase as they have a positive image of giving back into the community. So I would like to see the leagues, more so than even the teams, invest more in giving a bigger platform to their players, lifting them up, shining a bright light on all the work that they're doing, because it's the right thing to do. And candidly, it'll help the leagues out. This mm-hmm. will help ratings, sponsorship, everything works. It's like cause marketing for brands back in the 90s. It's an obvious next step that hopefully we'll see a lot of movement in coming up in the next.
I know what's hot today may not be hot tomorrow, but it is today. So what's hot? What are the experiences that bidders are really interested in at the moment?
So the more intimate or unique the experience, the more successful it's going to be. So a lot of times that's going to be speaking to the core fan base or pool of people who'd be interested in a specific experience. So if you know Bill Murray loves to play golf because he's on display at Pebble Beach every year at the AT&T, experience to play a round of golf with Bill Murray is going to outraise and outperform the chance to sit down at lunch with him.
Mm-hmm.
Fly fishing, going to the movies, having dinner at a really fancy restaurant. The more unique and intimate you can make the experience, the better it performs. In terms of the verticals or types of experiences, it really ebbs and flows with the calendar. So right now, in terms of sports, it's basketball, post-All-Star. Mm-hmm. As the playoffs are approaching, people are just inherently more interested in sports, business, experiences with finance executives. The market is tumultuous. People have a real interest in seeing what the most successful investors are going to be doing with their money. And right now, also travel is performing really well because, again, this mimics the peaks that you see in travel bookings across the web. It's when people are starting to plan trips. So we want to make sure we take advantage of that e-com trend.
You know, Charity Buzz is a technology company, and you sit at a very interesting intersection of high-tech digital fundraising on one hand and a sector that, by and large, is lagging in leveraging the full potential of technology. On the other, from your perch, share some of your observations of what you believe many nonprofits would be well advised to do to move forward in this realm.
I think just embracing all of the innovations and digital solutions that are out there. You know, there's an amazing stat about the percentage of GDP that has been directed towards charity has remained virtually unchanged since it was first measured in
mid-70s. Mm-hmm.
But the number of charities hasn't remained unchanged. We were just talking about this. We're approaching 1.5 million organizations. So it really requires these charities to separate themselves, create a greater sense of transparency about the work that they're doing, and take advantage of organizations like Charity Buzz to be able to reach new audiences, get their messaging out there. You know, we find too often charitable organizations who are just too comfortable in the status quo.
Yeah.
And we don't suggest that anyone stops doing what is currently working for them. Charity Buzz is not a substitute for your live auction. It is not a substitute for your gala. It is complementary. It is incremental.
It enhances.
One plus one.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, don't think that you have to give up what you're currently doing in order to take advantage of this booming space. So many organizations are jumping in with a lot of great solutions. Think about, there's extra dollars, there's extra awareness channels out there. Go out, learn more about it, take a risk or two, and I think you'll be really excited about the performance and the results.
Let me close with this, Ben, okay? What do you see as the next big innovation in this space, the next interesting twist, and what is your vision for Charity Buzz in the years ahead?
You know, unfortunately, the charitable sector doesn't move as fast as the for-profit sector, and we need to be cognizant of it as we think about the future. I strongly believe that Charity Buzz and the Charity Network have just scratched the surface. We like to say we're still in the bottom of the first inning, and there's a lot of work to do just to maximize our core products. So for Charity Buzz, it's increasing brand awareness, increasing number of charity partners and registered users within the U.S., but then also starting to take advantage of a lot of the trend and movement we're seeing in international markets and really becoming a global brand. And the same will be said across the Charity Network is we every single day have a conversation about what can we do today, tomorrow, next year to make these businesses more beneficial to our charity partners. We're advocating for them every single day. And that's really at the core of the business, the culture, and how we want to be positioned moving forward.
Well, Ben Irwin, the president of Charity Buzz, I want to thank you so much for being here this evening. For listeners who might want to see what auctions are currently running on your site or who may want to speak to the company about an auction for their nonprofit, what's your website and how do they get in touch?
So www.charitybuzz.com. Visit it often. There's always new auctions appearing on the site. Our typical auction life cycle is about 2 weeks, so it's dynamic. Sign up for the newsletter. We send out really, really exciting emails every single week. Anyone who's interested in partnering with us or just learning more about what we're doing, email me, ben@charitynetwork.com. I will get back to every single person that reaches out. And we're just looking forward to having conversations. And more than anything, thank you for the time. We really appreciate it. And this has been a really fun time.
Well, thanks, Ben. It was a real pleasure to have you on the show.
Thank you.
And that is this week's show. Thanks for listening. Have a great week and do return next Sunday evening for The Business of Giving.
The preceding program is paid for by the friends and partners of The Business of Giving.
3-star general Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.